Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your Hydro Seal extra large of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. That'll wake you up, huh? I know it's a little louder, a little harder, a little more forceful than we usually come in. What you are listening to is Power Trip, the Dallas thrash metal hardcore band. That is a song called If Not Us, Then Who? The frontman of Power Trip, Riley Gale, passed away at 34. You know, I'm embarrassed to say that I never got to write about Power Trip. It's a band I've been following and keeping an eye on for the last few years. Nightmare Logic, which is a record that came out in 2017. I just really, really love that record. And unfortunately, just never got around to writing about them. And when I saw that Riley had passed, I was really stunned and overwhelmed by the volume of the tributes, the intensity of the tributes, the emotional content, the intimacy. By all accounts, Riley was a special, earnest, moral, ethical, decent person functioning in and adjacent to scenes that sometimes are not those things. I was really taken by how directly his impact was felt on the individual level. And I realized now's the time. So we're going to celebrate Power Trip on this episode. We're going to talk about the band's career. We're going to talk about Riley Gale, what kind of songwriter and singer he was, what kind of person he was. I mean, look, the kind of singer and person he was is that If Not Us, Then Who? Is literally, the title is drawn from a quote from John Lewis. And that tells you pretty much everything that you would need to know about what kind of frontman Riley Gale was, what kind of band Power Trip was and is. So we're going to talk to three folks today. We're going to talk first to Dan Franklin. Dan is a metal journalist from England who did a really great interview with Riley in The Quietus a few years ago. Then we're going to talk to Andy O'Connor, who also writes about metal, lives down in Texas, and really watched Power Trip from its earliest days before its first album, from the days of its early EPs. And then finally, we're going to check in with James Kubiar, who is a longtime friend of Riley, booked some of the early Power Trip shows, runs Justified Arrogance, which is a very essential Instagram account if you're interested in hardcore and hardcore adjacent things. Each of them is going to speak to a different part of the Power Trip and Riley Gale story. In preparation for this week's episode and in the wake of Riley's passing, I went digging deep on old interviews because I wanted to not just absorb the music, I wanted to hear a lot about what he was saying because politics was very central to the Power Trip mission. There's a tremendous amount of skepticism and pushback to entrenched organizations and cultural norms that the band was really insistent on. And one of the best conversations I found was from 2017, so right around the release of Nightmare Logic, and that was on The Quietus, the very important British website, and it was done. The conversation was had by Dan Franklin. Dan, what's good, man?
Hey, man. Nice to be here.
I'm happy to have you. Dan writes regularly for The Quietus, put out a book this year. It's called Heavy, How Metal Changes the Way We See the World. Got a wild font on the cover, I see. very extreme font choices going on. But Dan, so you had this conversation with Riley that seemed to go in a lot of different directions. And it really touched on a number of things that I feel like were so crucial to why this band was bigger than simply, yes, they put out two records that were widely loved. There was something ideological, there was something thematic and something emotional about the content of the band. Can you talk to me a little bit about speaking with Riley and what your energy about the band was going into the conversation and kind of how that all unfolded?
It was the first time I'd ever spoken to Riley. I'd known of the band for a few years and I'd seen the band live the previous year in 2016, which was a fantastic experience and lived up to every expectation I brought to it in terms of them being at the forefront of a really a one band wave, sort of recasting thrash metal for a 21st century audience. And the conversation was interesting because I really only asked him, I'd say, about four or five questions, because he was, to say the least, very loquacious and very happy to speak at length and very generously about things that he cared about and which were important to him to get the message of the band across. So the first thing he said to me was, you know, I'm having loads of problems sleeping. I'm having loads of trouble with insomnia. I'm on sleep medication. I've got cotton mouth. I've just woken up. And you can hear him pulling on his cigarette as he's saying that. So to be talking about an album called Nightmare Logic, from the beginning, it's established with him that sleep is an issue. And, it, you know, thinking back to spring 2017, we were just stepping into the nightmare that is the Trump administration. And it was really at the outset of that. And he makes reference to, in the interview, having a sort of strange dream where he had a sort of sleep paralysis dream where he hallucinated his flatmate watching the TV with Trump signing all these executive orders. And so thematically, you know, we were away. I mean, it, he was able to speak at length about that feeling of paralysis, but where waking and dream and nightmare had become one for him in terms of how he felt about that whole bigger picture situation.
This record came out, I think it was February of 2017, so right after the inauguration, which means it was written and put together during the run-up to the election. And one of the things that he talks about in your conversation is this sense that things are looking worse and worse. You know, in a lot of ways, what was going on in 2016, if you had your eyes open, if you were paying close attention, you saw what was being portended for the years to come. And that energy and that frustration is very much in this album. It does feel like a early Trump era record, even though Trump was not actually the president when this record was recorded.
Yes, I think, you know, the drip feed of the news, that sort of background noise really kind of found its way into his lyrics. And with, I think, the best lyric writing, there's a lot of prescient stuff on that album, you know, and rereading the interview with him, you know, those issues he touches upon have exploded, especially this year. But if you look about the way he writes about white allyship on a song like If Not Us, Then Who?, you know, he talks about a friend who challenged him about what the appropriate way to behave is as a white person looking to support people who are from racial minorities or women in the scene, and the sort of some of the conundrums around the way of doing that and not being ham-fisted and screwing it all up. And looking back on that conversation and those lyrics particularly now, you know, that's a direct quote from John Lewis. So we're in a situation where, really devastatingly, I have to say today that those two people have passed. But, you know, for him to channel that voice now just feels like incredibly sort of ahead of the curve when it came to where we are all at the moment and the kind of nightmare we're trying to disentangle ourselves from.
Could you put that also in a little bit of context of the scene? Because you sort of joke that Power Trip is sort of a scene of one, a revival of one. But obviously they're put in a larger context, whether it's a larger metal context or they're on tour with much bigger bands or, you know, hardcore adjacent context. These kind of politics in some of those spaces are, I would not say, smiled upon. I think in some they're more receptive, but in some they're less receptive. Can you talk about Power Trip politics in the context of the scenes that the band was in or adjacent to?
I think it's very important to say that Power Trip come out of hardcore as much as they do metal. And so in the context of a lot of the bands that they toured with, a lot of the bands that they looked to for influence, and a lot of the bands that they then influenced, being politically and socially engaged is very much at the very core of a lot of the subject matter that those bands do. What makes Power Trip particularly interesting is that they were able to play at another level where they would get taken on the road. My mainstream metal acts, like Cannibal Corpse from the death metal scene, they were going to tour with Lamb of God. Lamb of God are an interesting band who definitely have political views, but somehow managed to kind of neutralize those to a certain extent in order to what you're alluding to there, you know, not stir it up too much. But you also have to remember, in the context of the great Texan metal scene, the great antecedents to Power Trip are really Pantera. And Pantera now, they leave a huge legacy in metal and I think delivered some of the most spectacular music in metal. However, they were very proud to display the Confederate flag. Phil Anselmo has got himself into a lot of hot water in recent years around some of his onstage proclamations, however intended they were or not. So, you know, for them to be, you know, as kind of, and I'm going to use the word socialist, as they were, it was very refreshing. And I think it also points to the fact that he really loved, Riley really loved the British hardcore punk and nascent metal scene of the late 80s, I should say, and early 90s. So we're talking about Napalm Death, Bolt Thrower, Sacrilege. These were all bands that were coming through in Thatcher's Britain and were very much like kind of against that entire capitalistic, individualistic, you know, society shunning system that we had over here. And that's where thrash originated from.
Let's actually listen to a little Bolt Thrower. Let's get people's heads open a little bit. What should we hear?
When we spoke, Riley was very keen to talk about how great he thought the Bolt Thrower album, Those Once Loyal, was. And I think we should listen to one track off there, which is pretty devastating, called The Kill Chain.
Love it. Let's do it.
Thrash has always been an inherently political music, and especially it emerged in the Reagan era. It really grappled with the specter of nuclear destruction. And Power Trip were exciting because they plugged straight into that tradition. And what could easily have been pastiche, though, they managed to make it feel so fresh. And I think that's because he really kept it up to date and very incisive with what he was writing about, as well as dressing it and coating it in the really kind of lurid subject matter that everyone knows and loves around thrash metal.
One thing I wanted to talk about, and again, that comes through very, very clearly in your interview with Riley, and this is something that I've noticed online in the wake of his passing, the sheer open-heartedness. And maybe that's political, maybe that's personal, maybe it's a combination of the two, but there is a genuine, big, emotional, almost like a warmth in this conversation, and certainly in the intensity of the tributes that I have read online. I've read thousands of tributes to people who passed away in my day, and I would say that the tenor of the Riley tributes has been singular in terms of his personality, his engagingness, and his decency as a person. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that aspect of your conversation and kind of and how that either did or did not tie into scene and scene politics.
I think what was refreshing about him was his willingness to just share his views and, more importantly, feelings about things. He was, as you say, he was emotionally open. He was pointed about what he wanted to put across without ever preaching or hammering me over the head with it. And I think that comes from a place of great security, I think, in his self and his beliefs. And that's why I think it was just easy to just kind of like set him off and let him talk, because he was such a good conversationalist almost with himself. And maybe that's what's interesting about him is sometimes you meet people who sort of are openly forming their opinions and forming their character in front of you. And those people are very appealing because they're not hiding and they're not concealing and they're not hedging around dimensions of their personality. And I think with him, it was all just very much there. And he's the sort of person where you talk to him for an hour and you felt like you made a friend. And one of my big regrets is I never took him up on the offer. You know, they were playing with Napalm Death, you know, a couple of months later. And he was like, you know, just drop me a line and we'll hook up beforehand. And I went to the gig and I just thought, I'm not going to bother him, you know?
Yeah, of course.
And that's just, you know, of course, now it's just easy to be full of regret about something like that.
I wonder if you can talk about the second album, because it seems that that's where things were really starting to coalesce. The lyrics are on point. The sound is big, but also extremely tight. Can you talk about that second album and where you felt the band was heading?
It was certainly a breakthrough and broke them through to a whole new audience. I think as well, you know, we shouldn't downplay the sense of fun they had around their sound. You can't write a song like Executioner's Tax about even a killer with the line, even a killer needs to get paid. And that line is at once deeply funny and also manages to make a point about a history of people who take money to kill other people from the military downwards, which is just, I think, deeply profound. So lyrically, it was like he was just working it on all those levels. You know, sonically, you know, the first album, it was very, it had loads of reverb. It was very deliberately kind of slightly cavernous in its production. This was sharper. It felt like they really sort of honed it into the bone. They were, you know, they just wanted to just cut through with this. And they have a mean line in breakdowns and they know when to hit mid-tempo. They knew when to just go for it on a song like Firing Squad. You won't find a better fast thrash metal song than Firing Squad. You just won't. I mean, I remember going to see them support Napalm Death and they came out and they played Soul Sacrifice. And it's when they come back into that introductory riff, slightly slower and just like it's the sledgehammer effect of that. And you just saw all these guys and girls in their 50s and 60s, you know, the old school. You just saw them look up from their beer and they were like, okay, who are these guys?
Let's do this again, Seattle. Put some feeling.
Glad you mentioned that because many, many people saw Power Trip in their natural context, you know, a small show, a house show, a small tour. But the fact that you saw it with that audience, I'm wondering more about how that audience was receptive or wasn't receptive to what Power Trip was doing.
I think what you can see, what I saw with Napalm Death, and they were, you know, two bands down the bill, and they were an outlier in terms of like a kind of grindcore gig. But you see this in the footage. I didn't go to Bloodstock in 2018, but you can see it where they're playing the main stage. There's a really good footage of it online. You can tell by watching something when an audience is bored or when an audience is being introduced to a band, and that you can kind of feel the sort of sense of something new landing with them. So actually, in a lot of the footage, this gig, everyone isn't necessarily going totally crazy, but They were building and there were people who were going to be going away and buying those albums. And I guess the question with Power Trip is where they would have gone if they'd had their time. I guess one of the tantalizing things at the moment is we know they were working on new music and how far down the line they got with that. And whether there might have been a natural ceiling on their sound. Their sound is extreme, you know. I mean, they'd have to make certain adjustments, I think, to break through into kind of the bigger sort of even within the metal scene. But that potential is all there. And that's what a lot of the kind of sadness around his passing is that unrealized potential.
Yeah, and also a thing that I think about Power Trip, and I remember feeling at the time that Nightmare Logic came out, you know, I'm old enough to remember when the anxiety about people paying attention to a band like this would be that it would somehow soften the band. It would somehow disentangle them from their scene. It would disentangle the band from the stylistic gestures that made it interesting and unique. I don't feel that way anymore, broadly speaking, but I feel like they had the gravitational center. I felt like they could continue to make records like this and earn more and more listeners while not fundamentally changing the essence of the band. Even the difference between the first record and the second record, to me, even though the second record is tighter, a little bit cleaner, it doesn't alter the fundamentals. And I felt like that was probably the path that they would go down, which is to say, stick close to core competency, get more and more people to pay attention, and that's a successful career.
Yeah, and what's also fascinating about them is how they got over to fans of other types of music, and you can see that in the kind of the write-ups of his death this week, a sort of wider understanding that they were an important band within their genre that sort of transcended their genre in the way that an act like, I think, Run the Jewels appeals to rock and metal fans, has that sort of crossover appeal. You might not know anything about hip-hop as a metal fan, but there's something in Run the Jewels which I think is very appealing to metalheads. And likewise, I think Power Trip, people get it from every, they just get it. They get the sound, they get the look, they get the energy, because it is just, there's something just so authentic about them when it could so easily have been completely inauthentic. It's that walking that razor's edge that they did. Because you could, you know, thrash, like, you know, people talk about indie landfill in the UK, but, you know, in the early 90s, where after Metallica got enormous, it was thrash landfill. You know, everyone was trying to be a thrash band. So to go 20, 25 years forward, and for them to kind of make that such an urgent genre again, when a lot of the more progressive and interesting stuff was happening in death metal and doom metal and arguably. So yeah, I think, you know, their one hand completely epitomized what they were doing, and then also just kind of instantly went over with people who liked all kinds of different types of music.
This was something that was on my mind, and I'm glad you kind of are arriving at this, because given the politics of the band, given the clear musical curiosity of the band, why do you think that they ended up choosing thrash as their kind of metier? I mean, obviously, like you say, it's thrash and hardcore. They're borrowing from both. You know, was it just that thrash was due for a reassessment? Was it that this pre-existing stuff that they were tapping into locally? Why thrash, do you think?
I think there's a few factors. You know, they are a particular kind of thrash metal which emerged called crossover, you know, and crossover in the 80s was almost like a nuclear fissile process between hardcore punk and heavy metal music, which came together. And it's almost like the ingredients were ripe again with an ascendant hardcore scene and all the other developments in metal for kind of history to repeat itself in a sense. And, you know, their influences that they look back on and the bands that were around them. And I also think the broader political climate, the fact, you know, around that time when they were forming, you know, North Korea, the Iran nuclear deal, all of this stuff was very sort of front page news again. It's something around that, the sort of cycle of what happens within the scenes and then the broader things that feed them. And the fact that they, you know, he was slightly older as well, you know, I mean, he was 34 when he died. So they weren't kind of ingenue like early late teens or early 20s, you know, they were pretty seasoned. And that's when, you know, when they sort of really hit their stride, they had that experience, I think, really counted for them.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting, the sort of, you know, the 20-year cycle or 25-year cycle, the kind of almost like a musical etymology of like, here are some things that made sense in the 80s when the political climate was this way, and here we have a renewed political climate that actually has a lot of resonance with that time period. So why wouldn't the music also start to echo what was happening then?
Yeah. I think that's true. And I think, you know, it's no coincidence that we have conservative administrations on both sides of the Atlantic at the moment. And I think, you know, because there's so much, I think, that feeds between the British and American scenes. And, you know, Power Trip was certainly loved over here as much as they were in the States.
Yo, Dan, thank you, man. I appreciate you checking in with us and giving a little bit of political and historical context to Power Trip.
No, great, man. I appreciate it.
Power Trip was formed in 2008, emerging out of Dallas. Power Trip was extremely well known in the scene before it grew to a wider acclaim in the late 2010s. When I was looking around, I found an article by Andy O'Connor. Andy had seen Power Trip a whole bunch in its early days, following the band all along. So we got to have Andy on the show. Welcome to Popcast, Andy.
Thanks for having me on. I wish you were talking under better circumstances, but I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, you and me both. So, Andy, if you don't know, Andy covers metal, hardcore, all your extremes for Spin, Pitchfork, Texas Monthly, Bandcamp Daily, et cetera, et cetera. This piece was on Vice from a couple years ago. Andy, talk to me about Power Trip 1.0, or even maybe 0.0. Maybe 0.0. Talk to me about the... Yeah, I'm going to figure that out. Talk to me about the real OG days and when you first encountered them.
First time I encountered them was a fun fest after show in 2011. That was a fest based in Austin every year that brought together like a lot of different genres, you know, metal, hardcore, hip-hop, like indie pop, you know, pretty all over the spectrum. And I don't remember who was playing with them. And I remember thinking like, oh yeah, this is like a pretty cool thrash band. And then a little bit after that show, I'd actually moved back to Texas. I was just visiting at the time. And I started to see them pop up more. And I was really digging the music, but moreover, just the like, these are some of those nuts shows I've ever seen. Like, kids were biggest circle pits, you know, kids just stage diving everywhere, like no matter how high, no matter how big the stage was, like kids just like going like off. And that's what I really like. That's where I knew like, okay, this is something else. Like, you know, these guys are really gonna make a big impact in Texas.
And you go to extreme shows all the time. What do you think it was about what Power Trip was doing that made kids respond that way? Why was it such, in essence, a safe space to wild out more so maybe than at other shows for similar type bands?
I've described sort of Power Trip shows as sort of like a like free form sort of like ballet in some terms, where everyone's going crazy, but there's like sort of a like a like a boundary or a logic to all the chaos. Like, no one's beating each other up, you know. If people get knocked down, people, they get picked back up immediately. Like, it's all love, like no bad vibes or anything like that. Like, people are respectful, but also it's a place to really just let out all your rage, just, you know, be free, you know, be happy, be mad, be angry. Like, it's really beautiful.
And is that like that kind of like, forgive the term, but like posse energy? How unusual is that energy in the scene and in the stuff you cover?
I've seen it before in more like hardcore leaning bands, but this is like the first time this sort of stuff had carried over to more of like a metal audience. Cause like, I've been to a bunch of like Slayer shows and stuff, and like sometimes those crowds can get like pretty aggro. Like, I would never describe Power Trip hits as being aggro, no malice. Like, it's all just fun and energetic and like just having a really great time.
So you first encountered them in 2011, so that's before the first full-length record. Were there songs of that era, the kind of 2010, 2011 era, were there songs of that moment that really stood out to you as being really strong?
The one that comes to mind is Suffer No Fool from their second EP. Yeah, second self-titled EP. It was just like this great sort of mix of New York hardcore and like really precise thrash, lots of great sort of mosh breakdown like sections. Like, it was just like that song, just really energetic, just really, you know, fierce and to the point, but also with crazy dive bombs, you know, and yeah, that really sticks out. That one really stuck out to me.
About what you saw happening with the band, because obviously if they're already at the point where they're playing Fun Fest, like, people are starting to pay attention to the band. How are they evolving, growing? You saw them a bunch of times. What did you see in their shows about how they were maturing?
I feel like a big thing was that even though that they're like in the mid-2000s and late-2000s, there's like a resurgence of thrash sort of brought on by bands like Municipal Waste and Warbringer. I feel like Power Trip wasn't really a part of all that, and yet somehow they were getting like stronger and more popular, like independent of any sort of like trend. Like, they were just doing what they were doing and people really responding.
Yeah, shout out Municipal. I haven't listened to Municipal Waste in a long time. I've not thought about Municipal Waste in a long time. I'm always happy to have them shouted out on podcast.
Yeah, Hazardous Mutation is still a classic that I
still goes. Now and then.
Yeah, it does.
What Power Trip was doing with thrash in terms of taking aspects of it, but also taking aspects from hardcore, that was not something that the sort of other parts of the thrash revival, that's not what was happening there. This was kind of its own pocket.
I would say that there's like some hardcore influence elsewhere, but like a lot more bands took from more of like the DRI, very sort of like short and fast part of it. Power Trip took more from like Cro-Mags, and in specific like sort of mid-period Cro-Mags, who are a little bit thrashier, you know, a little bit lengthier with the songs, but still really to the point. And you can't really talk about Power Trip without bringing up Iron Age, which is like legendary Austin band. And you could see where Power Trip really got a lot of what made them great from Iron Age. Like, Iron Age was combining thrash in a way that a lot of and other elements that other bands weren't really doing. Like, they were like bringing like hardcore kids and metal kids together. I wouldn't say they're like the first big Texas band, but I feel like after them, nothing was the same. Like, they really defined Texas hardcore, I would say, for the past decade. And Power Trip just sort of took that national. They took that to the next level.
Coming out of those early EPs, you arrive at 2013 with Manifest Decimation, which is the first full-length record. Can you talk about the sound of that record and kind of what it marked for the band, especially in contrast to or in concert with the EPs that came before it?
This is sort of the album where I'd mentioned Iron Age. They had gone a little bit dormant around this time, and I feel like this album sort of brought their sound and not only just sort of like rejuvenated it and brought it back again, but took it to like the next level. Cause you hear like a really sort of deep, kind of like reverb-y production, and Arthur Rizik, who's worked with the band, he's like a big part of that. They had met at the Sound and Fury Festival in California. Like, Riley was just traveling with the Iron Age guys who were playing it. I don't remember what year.
Oh, so that was because obviously Arthur goes on to do the production on these records. So that's where they originally met. Riley was with Iron Age when they met Arthur. I see. Okay.
Yeah, he was rolling with Iron Age out to Cali for Sound and Fury. And the band was already doing really hot performances, which you heard on the first two EPs. Arthur's sound just really gave them like so much depth. Like, you hear like these like reverby drums, these weird like drones that like start off the record. Yeah, like he really brought like their sound, like made their sound really deep.
Given that Power Trip was such an intense live band, to what degree do you think that intensity and kind of almost mayhem, but also very uplifting energy translated to the records?
I'll say like at the end of the day, Power Trip have the songs. And even though I'd heard some of these songs a bunch, like before the record came out, I feel like just like how tight they are. And at the same time, how Blake Ibanez, who plays lead guitar, like how he was able to like really just go off and like sort of set everything off with his like dive bomb sort of whammy bar abuse solos. Yeah, it's like a lot of metal, great metal to me, is able to straddle the line between like really competent performance and just this unbounded chaos, or sort of this like pre-civilization fury. And this is another example of that, how they straddle those lines. And yeah, you could totally hear it.
Given that you've seen so many Power Trip shows, I wonder if there's one in particular that sticks out in your mind after all these years.
Oh, there's quite a few. Power Trip is the only band that I've stage dived for. Like, and it was a show at this venue in Austin called the North Door with a bunch of like really hot like Austin locals. And something just possessed in me to just go all out and just jump into people. And like, I'm a big dude. Like, you don't want to see me coming. but people, you know, they had my back.
They caught literally. You. They caught you. Yeah. They let you. Okay, great.
Yeah, they caught me.
It's also important to mention there is a really good live album that came out, a Power Trip live album, Live in Seattle, 5/28/2018. That captures a lot of that energy.
There's one song that I feel like I have to mention from Manifest Decimation.
Oh, I was just about, that's actually what I was just about to ask you. Go in.
Yes, my favorite Power Trip song of all time, and people that know me know this about me, is Crossbreaker.
Go in. Speak on it.
That like hard bass intro, how it just goes into this, just one of the hardest rips I've ever heard from any metal band. Like it's most hardcore bands have mosh parts. This is an entire mosh song. Like it's just slamming and everyone's on point. Riley is, you know, bringing his best like hardcore sort of like preacher energy on here. Cause I mean, even though there's a lot of metal that is, you know, pretty like critical of Christianity and organized religion, it also engenders this sort of fervorousness and like spirituality. And in a way, like metal has replaced religion for me and for some other people. And this track is definitely like, it's not just a song, it's a hymn.
Yeah, I can't think of a better way to close out the segment than with that ringing endorsement. So let's go out with some Crossbreaker. Andy, I appreciate you, man.
Thanks again for having me. Even with Riley's unexpected loss, I'm really happy to talk about Power Trip. They've truly made me proud to be from Texas like no one else has.
Our last segment today, you know, I've mentioned earlier in the episode seeing the outpouring of tributes to Riley and the particular emotional tone and resonance of those tributes. And as I was kind of keeping an eye on things online over the last couple of days, I kept returning over and over again to an Instagram page that I follow and and actually have bought a shirt from, someone I've kind of sort of chatted with a little bit on Instagram. And the intimacy of the posts and the remembrances just really, really stuck with me. And I realized I had to reach out to this person to see if he'd be willing to talk about Riley. And luckily he was. So we have James Kubiar here. James runs an IG page. It's called Justified Arrogance. I have a great body count shirt that I copped from him. First of all, just go to his IG page. You see where James's interests lie. James used to be a writer. Justified Arrogance was a blog before it was an IG page. And most crucially for today, James and Riley were good friends. And I'm really glad that James was down to come and chat to us. So James, man, thank you, man. I appreciate that.
Thanks for having me here today. I really appreciate it.
Of course. So if you could talk a little bit about getting to know Power Trip and Riley and when that was and what you knew about him and the band even before meeting them.
So actually, I don't know how many people know, I booked Power Trip's first show, actually.
I did not know that, no.
Yeah, it was April 22nd, 2008. They opened for Blacklisted. 70 kids showed up. And this is a true story. So they loved covering intros, loved it. And they covered one in particular that day, Leeway's The Future Ain't What It Used to Be, but like it's a really good intro. And the first time they had an equipment malfunction, so they did it again. And then it turned out that Hood, who's like he's basically like Riley's like brother and like has been with, he like did merch for the band for like 11 years. He's been around forever. He wasn't there. So he showed up late, and then they did it again so Hood could see it. Honestly, that summed up what the band was about. It was like, we're going to have fun and we're going to do it for our friends. And I think that stayed true the whole time. To go back to your original question about my relationship, I've known Riley since 2005. It's actually 2004, I guess the last month of it. But we met at the Heavyweights of Hardcore tour with that Hatebreed did with like Terror and Sick of It All and No Warning.
And this is in Dallas?
In Dallas, yeah. I was actually planning to move away before I met Riley. That's a whole different sidebar. I could talk about how much Riley Gale has personally directed and influenced my life, and I could be here all day. But we became friends, and we partied together, and we went to college together. We both went to North Texas, and you know, we hung out all the time. We used to get lunch together and just whatever. We were pretty, I mean, as a group, we were all pretty inseparable. He was in a band prior to Power Trip called Balls Out, and Balls Out were like cult hometown heroes. I can't begin to explain. I will tell you this, the biggest show I've ever booked in Dallas was a Balls Out show. And I've booked like Have Heart, I booked Blacklisted, I booked Cold World, I booked everybody. And Balls Out still the biggest show I've ever booked in Dallas.
What was it about Riley that set him apart from other kids in the scene, that made him, you know, the front man that he was? What are the kind of generative things that he would do that really stood out to you even at that early stage?
Everybody was his friend, but I don't mean that in the fake way that, you know, like you hear that a lot and it's usually meant to be like a negative comment. It was very open and it was very trusting, and he gave you the benefit of the doubt, and he always believed that you could do good or better. And he was always rooting for everybody. And for me, I got kicked out of college when I met him, and I told him I was dropping out. And he was like, "That's pretty f-ing stupid, man." And I signed up. I'm serious. And I signed back up for community college. And, you know, I ended up at North Texas like a year later. Yeah. But like little things like that, man. But like, that wasn't just me. That was, and he didn't know me from Adam. And he goes, "Who'd you come to the show with?" I was like, I'm here alone. He's like, "Cool, come with me." And he's like, "Hey man, like this is my new friend, James." He's introducing me to all these people. Half those people that I met that night are still my friends to this day. That's who he was. So I was like, he tried to give himself to everybody, and he put himself into everyone.
Was that rare? I mean, look, that's rare as a human. Like, that's rare just from human beings, you know? But was that rare in the scene as well? Because, you know, sometimes the scenes can be really cloistered or difficult to crack or, you know what I mean? Like, hard to access.
Oh, absolutely. And no, he was one of a kind. Like, Dallas especially was very aloof and very segmented. So like punks didn't mess with hardcore kids.
there were like metalcore kids who didn't like hardcore kids. Like it was, and Riley would tell me all the time, he's like, if we could figure out a way to unify all these groups, like we as a city would be unstoppable. And we would talk about this all the time as kids, and we would be scheming, and like, I'm not kidding you. Like we'd be hanging out at his house and he'd be talking about ways to like reach out, like on some like Kissinger on like how to like extend Olive Branches to other scenes by booking other bands. And he was the one who brought that into Dallas because that was not a thing. And it worked. And we did become unstoppable. He was right, you know? And, but like he knew that all along. I'll give you one more personal example. So admittedly in my youth, I was annoying. What do you want me to say? I was really punny. I was
who can relate? It's totally fine. It's who among us.
I was a punisher, a vicious punisher. And kids did not want me around. And they were like, you're a tourist, you're not gonna last, and you'll be gone in a week. And I remembered exactly where I was standing, and I remember this, but I don't remember the show specifically. But it was summer 2005. And Riley just goes, yo, Sex Song goes out to my friend James K. If anybody here has a problem with them, you have a problem with me. And everybody backed off. That set the tone for our friendship for the next 15 years. And like, we, you know, I remember in like 2017, we had a bit of a misunderstanding. And the way I cleared it up is I was like, Riley, I was like, you're my brother. I love you more than I love a lot of my family. And I was like, whatever happens to you happens to me. And like, anybody who wants to go through you has to go through me first. And like, but he set the tone for that 15 years earlier or 14 years earlier when he said what he said, you know? But that wasn't just like a me thing. He invested himself like that into everybody. He wanted to be there for everybody. Even when he couldn't be there for himself, he would be there for others. Like that's who he was.
When I was looking at all those tributes, I was seeing tributes from not just, you know, people in different band, like types of bands or types of scenes, but just all over the country. Even people who casually knew him had something like that seemed warm above and beyond the kind of like, yeah, I met so-and-so once, they were cool. You know, it seemed that he left this incredibly forceful impression on people. What do you think about him was the thing that left that kind of forceful impression, even on folks that he maybe had only had brief or fleeting encounters with?
I'm going to quote a friend of mine who said this today, but he said, Riley could make you feel like you were the only person in the world. And I don't know what word there is for that. If you want to call it charisma or you want to call it charm, whatever it was, he had it. And he could do that. And he did that with everybody, you know, and he was one of a kind, man.
Do you feel like his personal energy was integral to the sort of way that Power Trip was received, that people were even more open to the band and more open to the music and more open at the shows specifically because of the connection with his energy?
Absolutely. Oh my God. That's not only that, but like, that's the reason why kids would like put themselves through a wall at those shows. I posted it on Facebook. I haven't put, but if you search for Dallas, and I recommend this to anyone listening, search for Dallas Edge or Not Day 2012 Power Trip, and you'll get an idea of what those shows were like. But that was what the energy was, right? Is before it was like pro, before it was anything like that. It was kids, like kids in a, not even, I keep saying kids, friends. Everyone in the room were friends. We were friends in a room. We were just having fun, you know? And I think that's what it was. It was never like, and he always said that. And that's not like a him thing as much. Like, I don't know if you've ever watched like old, or if you were around for the time, but like, you ever watch like old Hatebreed or old like terror videos from like the 90s and the 2000s? That's a big component of like hardcore, is the idea that like the band is a part of the audience and the audience is a part of the band. And Riley and I talked about that a lot, and he took that to heart. I still live, I'm 34, and like, you know, I still get like chills when I hear vocalists say that. And Riley was one of the last ones to really espouse that view on stage.
From what it seems like, that energy was not just narrowing the space between audience performer, but it was also a very positive kind of intensity, a very almost like a nurturing kind of intensity. Is that safe to say?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I know that I'm like hyping it up and I'm making it sound like Game of Thrones or something. No, I mean like there was a lot of love in those rooms. Like, I mean, you know, it's funny. I saw that Edgernate video, like somebody was like, yeah, I broke my finger. Somebody threw one of those chairs and I threw that chair and I was like, I'm sorry. I love you. I didn't like this is yesterday. I had that conversation and I'm like, I'm sorry about that. That's my bad. And so it's like, yeah, like it was crazy, but there was always love there. I think like there was never not love.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about Riley as a songwriter and as kind of a thinker, because it certainly seems like a lot of energy and a lot of sort of like vernacular philosophy went into the lyrics. And he was very careful about what he said, what kind of causes he wanted to take on. I'd love to hear more about that.
I remember when that shifted, actually, because he was always a smart dude, like very, very sharp, switched on. But like philosophically, I remembered I came over and there was a big Foucault book on his table. And I was like, what's that? He's like, oh, it's the coolest. And he starts telling about Foucault. And then every week after that, it was like this like lesson where he'd just talk about like Foucault or Zizek or whatever he was reading at the time. And I got into it because I was a poli-sci major. He was an English major, but I would like, you know, grab him stuff that was like philosophical, but like politically relevant. So I would get him like, I'd go on a trip. I'd come back with like a copy of like The Leviathan by Hobbes. And he'd be like really into that. He got gifts a lot from like whatever, but he loved books. God, that was his favorite. And when he started to become more well-read, the lyrics started to expand their worldview. So I think when he was like, it balls out, it was like very personal. Cause he's like a high school kid basically when he started that band. Like you could tell he had the grasp for words. Like he was always a really good wordsmith. But once he started to become more well-read, that's when like the worldview starts to expand. And that's what you start to see in Power Trip. Like the first record, Armageddon Blues, is a lot of that, you know, like specifically the song Armageddon Blues. And I mean, like there was always tinges of spirituality. He came to reject religion.
Yeah, and I was reading in one of the interviews where he sort of was getting pushback about having a cross on maybe one of the record covers. And he was like, yeah, but there's – or maybe a star, a Jewish star, Star of David. And he was like, yeah, but there's also a cross. There's also Islamic imagery. Like it's basically – I'm skeptical of all of it, like organized religion, broadly speaking.
I actually remembered when they got the artwork back. And we were like, that could be a problem. And we were like – we were like, it'll be fine. And like, so it's 7 years later. That's good to know.
You know, when I read that in that interview, I was like, the kind of earnestness of it, the like, no, I am genuinely questioning all these things. And like, you know, if this causes you some discomfort because I'm using this imagery, like, I understand that. But also like, you know, I'm on a mission. Like, I'm on a quest to ask hard questions about this stuff.
It was a quest. Like, and I think that's the idea, is he was growing. He was always like, we were always growing, man. Like, and he was always growing and he was always like working on wanting to be a better version of himself. And like, I know that Power Trip got the rep for being like one of the more progressive metal bands out there. And that comes from being hardcore kids, because like, yo, like if you go to a hardcore show and you're sexist or homophobic or you're racist, you're going to get beat up.
Yes, like literally beat up, like actually.
Yeah,
beat up.
Yeah. And I mean, and you know, like that's how it should be. I mean, like, yo, no offense, like you shouldn't have to abide that. And so for him coming into metal, and we talked about this a lot, because it was like, oh, you're coming to metal, and you know, some of the listeners are gonna be pissed off hearing this, but like for better or worse, metal's audience is not as inclusive as others. I cleaned that up nicely. Thank you.
Yes, you did. It's okay. It's a relatively safe space to say something like that, but I know what you mean. I know what you mean.
And so, and yeah, like that was always like how far could you go with it? And I think obviously with the current social climate, cultural climate, whatever you want to call it, Riley was just like, yo, we are a metal band, but we do believe these things. And if you have a problem with it, off. And I think that's powerful. I think using your platform.
But it also seems that like in his life, what he really was setting out was a pathway for good living, a pathway for ethical living, a pathway for empathetic living. It was obviously channeled through music and channeled through a sound and a scene, but it seems like humanity was at the core of all of those things.
He understood the plagues of the world, and he was trying to give people a roadmap to beat it.
As we're coming to a close, I wonder if you could talk a little bit. You already kind of indicated that you were able to watch the evolution in the songwriting kind of happen in real time. And as we're kind of going out, I wonder if there's one song, you know, one particular moment that feels like deeply emblematic and would be like a great way to wrap out the episode.
You know, it's funny. No one's ever asked me that. No one's ever put a gun to my head and said, pick one Power Trip song. So ever, which is crazy. You know what? I'm actually going to go with Power Trip. That song's really important to me because I think that it really defined Riley's personal life philosophy and the idea that like everything that we did was for each other, but on our own terms. Like forget the cops, forget parents, forget jobs, like forget everything. It's just us. The last few days, all I've thought about is everybody and everything and how much Riley was interconnected with all of it, you know? And Power Trip, I think, kind of hits that in a way where it's like, we're going to keep doing it. We're going to keep doing it for him and for each other because that's what he would want.
We are going to go out with Power Trip, by Power Trip. For you, James, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate you having me.
This was a good break and to celebrate the life of the best human I've ever known.
So for Riley, that's our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Get on the Facebook group. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We'll be back next week. This is Power Trip, playing Power Trip.